So change. And for those of you who know some about Hmong, so much of the literature about Hmong are based on the pre-Vietnam War era, or the literature or scholarly work about Hmong integration or the problems that Hmong have in the United States. So there's so much missing between that the Vietnam War era. So much transformation occurred during those more than a decade of war in Laos, but we often don't have anything about that period. We may have a few memoirs written by, you know, international volunteer workers in Laos, so they may talk about their experience working with these, you know, primitive people in the villages, but not a whole lot. But there was so much transformation in those 10 years of, you know, the CIA with the army and people's, when all the men went to war. Women's lives changed too. They didn't only do their part, they did all of men's work, as well as their own. So they're, you know, in so many aspects. So when I went back to graduate school, I have been traveling around the world a great deal, looking at the lives of Hmong people who have resettled in Western countries after the Vietnam War era. I've went to France, to Argentina, and also to different places across the United States. And as a researcher, for my dissertation, I interviewed 35 people who were primarily based in the Twin Cities. But many of them had lived in other parts of the world as well as other parts of the country. So my book that's coming out this fall with Illinois University Press, Hmong America, I've decided to call it Hmong America, it is really integrating the oral history interviews I've done with a lot of the archival research. And I chose to do oral history interviews because when I was a little bit younger, I was trained as a social scientist. I love administering surveys and, you know, running multiple regressions and chi-squares and all of that fun things, right? But I also love to talk to people because those numbers are great. They tell us about trends and all kinds of wonderful descriptions about various communities and places. But what was missing in the archives that I was visiting, whether it's in Paris or in the Immigration History Center or anywhere else at the, you know, University of Texas, the History of Aviation, they have all the Air America archive there. I spent quite a bit of time there. What was missing was yes, you have all these experiences by, you know, Americans who were there, but what was missing was how did the Hmong people, how did the other people who live in those villages, how did they see this era? What did they experience? I mean, there are Hmong people flying T-28 planes. So the image that they're all primitive, they don't understand, you know, anything about technology. You know, I'm sitting in the Immigration History Research Center looking at these case records. These are files that people have in the History Center where they apply for immigration to the United States. Okay, so in these files, you'll have case records of families, numbers, all the demographic data, right? And then you'll have assessments by the, you know, the workers about whether or not these people will do fine in America. That's all wonderful, right? But I started to see these, they have these plans that people have to create within these case files. What do they want to do when they get to America? Okay, so they have all kinds of careers, what they want to do. And I saw so many people wanted to be mechanics. And I said, why would they want to be mechanics, right? And so it's through the oral history research that I learned that during the whole, you know, Secret War of Laos, so many of the men were trained because the Americans who were there were just CIA case officers or a few pilots, but you needed people to fix the planes, you need people to drive the jeeps. So there's these people, you know, operating all these high-tech equipments in these tiny villages in northern Laos, that history has been sort of erased, right? What we hear are just the great leaders or the politics of, you know, that era. But you don't hear a lot about these individual lives and what they experienced, their camp experiences. A lot has been written by workers, international relief workers who went to the camps or who may have worked with them in this country, but a lot of it from a very outsider perspective. So I was a refugee child and, you know, lived through a lot of these experiences that my elders were experiencing. So for my, for that dissertation, I interviewed about 35 people. Of course, I mean, all the things that you've been talking about, the problems you learned, so many that I experienced as well. I videotaped almost all of my interviews. I gave people a choice to conduct the interviews in Hmong or in English. It was their choice. Although most spoke some English, they all chose to speak Hmong because they said that it was easier for them to talk about their feelings, express themselves. These are older individuals in their 50s and 60s, and some even a little bit older, so it was impossible for them to speak English and express themselves. So when you talk about voice recognition, I said, well, can we have one in Hmong? So the disadvantage is that it's time consuming, right? When you conduct the interviews in Hmong, and then you have to sit down, transcribe it all into Hmong, and then you have to translate it all into English, it's sort of doubling the efforts that you do. But I really think it's important for us to do this kinds of data collection, because I think the theme that many of you talked about earlier is these individuals are dying. Many have died, and many will continue to die, and they're not going to be here to share their stories. So this year, so that's my own work. Okay, so if you are any interested in Hmong, yeah, the book will be out in November, so hopefully I'll talk more about it as it comes out. But this year, I was able to get a small grant. I've been teaching, I teach the Vietnam War class here, and then I also teach a smaller course on Hmong history and culture. And what I've learned is that so many of the students come into the classroom, some are angry at their parents, right? They say, well, why didn't my parents tell me about this? Or why didn't they tell me about that? And so I have to often tell students, you cannot blame your parents. Many people didn't understand these larger geopolitics or these larger political social transformations. They know their experience in front of them, but they may not be able to explain to you all these larger things that were happening because most people, even Americans, didn't know what was going on. So what I've done this year is that I think Julia said earlier today that oral history engages students. And so this year I was able to get a small grant from the Office of Undergraduate Research. And the idea is to really help to build capacity of undergraduate students to design their own project and to conduct the research and learn how to analyze them. And the goal is that I want to build capacity so that more students will go to graduate school. And all the, you know, data that's sitting in my basement, I haven't decided where to, you know, give it to yet, but they're sitting in my basement, and I love to, you know, have those become accessible to students as well as future researchers. So we'll talk more about that project. But for today, the three of the students are part of this new Southeast Asian research project. We call it Southeast Asian because, just because, you know, I am of Hmong origin doesn't mean that we're only limiting it to just Hmong individuals. There's a lot of Hmong and Cambodian and Lao and Vietnamese refugees in this area too. So we have a small project that the Office of Undergraduate Research funded. It's only $10,000, but we were able to get, you know, work with six students. They have to apply to be a part of it because this is not a class. They're not getting any credit. They're getting a small stipend to work on this project, but this is above and beyond their own schoolwork and other work and anything else that they're doing. So these are very, very motivated students. The three that are presenting today are have chosen oral history as a method. I tell them that it's a project that they are interested in. So the other three are doing slightly different. One is actually doing much more of what I used to love to do, right, a survey, but these three are using oral history, and they're pretty, you know, they're innovative, and with the availability of technology, they're doing great things that I wish as an undergraduate student I knew how to do. So what I'm going to do is just ask each of them to speak. I've told them maybe eight minutes or so, 8 to 10, and then we'll leave a little bit of time at the end for you to ask them questions. And again, they're all undergraduate students. I think the first one, Sue, are you ready to go first? Yeah. Okay, so Sue Her, they'll tell you a little bit about themselves, their major, so that I cannot speak so much. But Sue Her will go first, and then Bao Nye Yang will go, and then Lee Xiong is an undergraduate student at Madison. So he's not part of the research project we're doing, but he has been using oral history as a way to gather data for his project at Madison. And then Paku Lee will go last to share with us their projects. Thanks.
Hi, everyone.
Do you want to use the microphone?
Yeah. Do you want me to
speak
here, or?
It's up to you. Yeah, it's, unless you speak really.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sue, and I am currently a sophomore here at UW-Milwaukee. I am majoring in criminal justice and minoring in information resource. I first heard of the Southeast Asian American Research Project through my job as an office assistant on campus in the Southeast Asian American Student Services Office. I've long been exposed to the different aspects of my Hmong culture and see that the important rituals and symbolisms that we have are slowly fading away. So in order to preserve the Hmong culture, I joined SARP to take on a more vital role in informing others of the Hmong culture and preserving it as well. My future end product, or product of the project, will consist of a small scrapbook full of pictures and short transcripts from interviews regarding select Hmong artifacts and the stories and people behind them to better understand the history of the Hmong culture. More specifically, the purpose of my project is to help bring to the surface personal perspectives on important artifacts that contribute greatly to a young Hmong generation that doesn't quite understand its roots. Being of Hmong descent, I feel it is important that I interpret my own history. With my perspective, I aim to reach out to others whom, like me, have quite a way to go in understanding how my ancestors and parents may have lived. I chose this research method because I feel it best gives both the interviewee and I a voice. I don't dictate what the interviewee wants to share with me, and I become more interactively involved in the process as a whole. I find that talking with elders is rewarding because I see the glow in each individual, and the most interesting part is trying to figure out what they were like and how they lived when they were about my age. Although it's quite a task, I feel I've gained personal knowledge a book may not have been able to provide me. It is these kinds of experiences that become truly priceless. A challenge that I've experienced in conducting interviews with elders is the comfortability of sharing information. And with all cultures, I'm pretty sure it's not something that is too big of a difference. But in the Hmong culture, people don't normally give out so much personal information, even if, you know, the person that is interviewing them is of the same origin. And I think that it could be due to just, you know, not knowing enough about the project itself. But that was one of the barriers that I did sense right away with a select individual that I was interviewing. And also physical or medical conditions do hinder the effectiveness of the interviews. Additionally, time is of essence, and to make interviews so structured, such as to meet at a certain time and whatnot, it makes the elders, especially in the Hmong culture, they feel sort of overwhelmed and put to work, and that's something that you just have to be very sensitive to. I encountered this particular challenge in one of my interviews as well, and I tried to complete it to the best of my ability. Majority of my interviews that I have conducted are with Hmong elders, usually above the age of 50. I did interview one. I'm still having a hard time trying to decide whether she's Thai or Laos because I myself don't know much about it. But that was one barrier because all she spoke was Thai, and I had to talk to the coordinator, and she kind of translated, so it was like a three-way kind of thing. So it was really interesting, but I learned a lot, so that's the good thing. But overall, my interviews have gone really well, and I learned some new things from each individual and would like to delve deeper into the aspect of their daily life and how the artifact use comes to impact it. I hope to gain much more information so that I can analyze and interpret what significance these artifacts have on the Hmong culture, but I do know that this also helps me to brush up on my Hmong speaking skills, something I want to make sure I can do. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Bonye, and I am a education major here with minors in ESL and science. I'm also part of the Southeast Asian American Research Project, and my portion of the project basically is to capture the Hmong people, their journey from Laos to Thailand, and then Thailand to America, and how that experience has affected them and their lives, and really just capturing their life story. So it's pretty exciting. One of the reasons we were talking about, like, why, what motivated us to join with SARP, and I really don't think that it was really motivated. I think I was slowly being prepared to conduct interviews with the older Hmong people. It all started with my very first education course here at UWM, and it was actually on African American history, which is kind of cool, the civil rights movement and everything. We began to learn that during the civil rights movement, a lot of times when Black History Month comes around and we as teachers have to teach it, we only teach about the heroes, and we don't actually teach about the people who went through the suffrage, who actually supported and really participated in the actual movements so that the movements could actually occur. And so a lot of the times during the civil rights movement, only people who were considered like the heroes or the major people, they would be the ones being interviewed, but not a lot of the civilians, or the civilians were being interviewed, or none of that was being being archived or anything. It really struck my heart then that, you know, with Hmong history, we don't really have anything archived. There's not really a lot of information on it. Well, as far as I've known, because I haven't been, it's not readily available to me as a student. And then it went on from there. I took the American Indian History course here, which is part of the Act 31 for teachers. And we learned about how in American Indian, their culture, a lot of things are passed on through oral traditions. And that's how their rituals, their culture was preserved and maintained and passed on from generation to generation, even down to simple things of ricing and just very, very simple things of their lifestyles and everything. And so it was kind of like a snowball effect, like everything was kind of rolling together. And then I was in my one of my ESL teaching courses, and all of a sudden the terms endangered and extinct got applied to language, and it scared me. It made me really think about the Hmong culture and like our language, and how Lucy Say, I don't know if you guys ever read her book, it's called Why Don't They Learn English? Separating Fact from Fallacy. And in her book, she talks about heritage language loss and how by the third generation, the native language is lost. And I look a lot at the Hmong language itself, and that it's pretty true. Like among the Hmong people, our language is pretty much lost by the third generation. So it was kind of scary. So then it started this. I started to feel like, what are we going to do? What can I do? What can the people around me do to help preserve this? To help maintain our culture, our history, our language, just everything. And then I met Dr. Chia, and she presented this to me. I heard about the Southeast Asian Research Project, and it really, it's really just been a really big blessing, like, to be a part of it. So that's kind of what motivated or prepared me to kind of conduct these interviews with the elder Hmong people. I chose to do the interviews with the older Hmong people because I felt it was a little bit easier, because I don't mind speaking to the older Hmong people. I think it's very fun. They have a lot to say, and a lot of the people that I've talked to, they just kind of spill their guts out. They just say it all, and so it was really, and it was a lot easier because then, like, we have a recording of it and video of it, so I can actually take it back and use it and archive, like we want to archive it. So that's kind of why I chose the interview method. I think the most rewarding part about doing these interviews is that I've gotten to know a lot of these my participants, and like really understand older Hmong people, and just really experiencing all the things they have gone through by what they're telling me. And it's also been really, really cool to see, talking to the different participants that I have, their stories connect. They all, it's all pretty consistent with one another. And it's really exciting just to see that. And then also just seeing that how, because growing up, I've always heard people say, you know, my parents, you know, my grandparents, uncles and aunts, they always talk about how they missed Laos and how they wish to go back there and all of these things. And now I understand why, because back then, like, their lifestyle to them was, it was good, you know, they loved it back in Laos. And it's been really cool to, like, understand that. And another, I guess, another really rewarding thing is I've learned so much more about the Hmong, about like the Hmong history. Like I never knew about the Crazy War, you know, and now I know about it and it's like, whoa, okay, I never knew that even happened. And how it was like before the Vietnam War and just the different areas of Laos and like the map of it and like where Hmong people lived in Laos. And it's been really, 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 really fun. But and then also just really getting better at speaking Hmong, because, you know, I don't feel like, because since I was born here in America, I feel like I'm not as good at speaking Hmong, and especially if I want to be an ESL teacher, specifically working with Hmong students, I feel that that really needs to be worked on. One of my biggest challenges with working with interviewing the Hmong people was during when they went from Laos to Thailand, I didn't realize how secretive it was for them. So even now when I'm interviewing them, my participants are really timid about speaking about it. Even though it's been like 30 plus years, they still are struggling with sharing how they went from Laos to Thailand. Like, I believe they used the old trading routes that were from, you know, from Laos to Thailand. And so that's how they knew where to go to get to Thailand. But like, one of my participants that I interviewed did not want to mention names, did not want to mention how many people were in their group. It was very, very, secretive. And it was just, it's really shocking to me, because I would assume that, you know, this is something safe for them. It's been 30 years, you know, 30 years have passed and they should feel safe about it, but it's still very secretive to them. And one of my other challenges was, since I had that barrier, I didn't really know how to dig or probe deeper. So that's something that I've been trying to work on. And then another challenge that I came across was they were talking about the different regions that they were from, and it was really, really hard, because the first time I didn't have a map, so the second time I brought a map so they could like point out where they're from and like where they are moving and their migrations and stuff, because it was really confusing, because they don't say like north, south, east, or west. They just say like there and there, here and there, down there. So it's really confusing. I brought a map. I guess my end product of what I kind of want to go with my project is just my portion of the project is I just really want to capture their life stories and where they're going and like that journey, because that journey has so much in it. Like there's like love stories and there's like all these things are tied into that time, you know. Even though the war was going on, they still had families and they still had children and they still had wives and husbands. And a lot of times during that time they weren't even together because of the war. Like the husband was off defending and the woman was doing all these things to maintain the family. And so I think my end project is I just really, really want to see how the war affected them and how the migration and just really capturing their life stories through this. So that's my project. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'll try to keep this as short as possible. My name is Li Yang, and I am a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My project is titled Hmong Folklore in America. More specifically, I'm interested in folklore stories. Originally, I was interested in the history of the Southeast Asian Hmong people in China. That's what I was interested in. But, you know, as I soon learned, was that Hmong people did not have a written language. Until their migration into Southeast Asia, did they learn to read and write. And only then, only a very select few number of Hmong people learned how to read and write. And so when I was looking at this project, because I couldn't get access to any written historical records, what I would have to look at is instead the oral tradition, Hmong oral tradition. And as I've also learned, oracular knowledge changes with respect to person, with respect to place, and with respect to time. And what I mean by this is who tells the story differs from person to person, and who learns the story differs from person to person with respect to what that person understands the story to be. And then also with place. Your experiences of a certain place, the people you've met, will inevitably change how you look at how stories come about and how you come to understand stories. And so because I'm studying Hmong Americans in America, I would have to take into account the diasporic experiences of the Hmong people. And so as such, what I'm looking at are, first and foremost, I'm primarily interested in stories. But secondly, I'm looking at how stories are used in the, as Kieran Narayan, one of my professors, says, in the coming to and belonging of Hmong Americans in America. And that's with respect to how are stories remembered and in what ways are stories remembered, right? And so that's what I'm doing. My motivation for this is, well, as a refugee and the son of refugee parents, what child wanted to grow up knowing that their parents are refugees, were refugees? And so that for me, you know, I grew up rejecting my Hmong culture. But in the process, I've learned to come to realize that, well, first of all, I don't know anything about my Hmong people. You know, why am I trying to reject them when I don't know anything about them? And so within the past few years, I've come to not only accept, but to become proud of who I am, my heritage. And so that's why I'm motivated into doing this. My methodology and rationale. Well, if you're talking about oral tradition, and this is how I rationalize this. If you're talking about oral tradition, then you would have to get it from the elderly people, right? And so what I did was I interviewed primarily all Hmong refugees, you know, aunts, uncles, friends of my aunts and friends of my uncles, grandparents. Before I talk about the rewards, let me get into the challenges. There were a lot of challenges along the way. As my professor said to me, who you are and what you represent affects your interviews. And what I mean by that is, when I go into an interview, the first thing that people notice is that, first of all, I'm a student, right? So if I'm trying to conduct an interview with the Hmong community or with anybody within the Hmong community, I can't say I'm doing this for a paper, for a class, for a grade, because if you do that, you know, and often I've experienced this, is that people will say, I don't know enough about this. This is something that I don't know about. Why don't you ask somebody else? But if you say, well, you know, I'm a Hmong person myself. I'm interested in learning about this for my own sake so that I can, you know, maybe someday teach other people about this. And then, you know, surely enough, they'll say, okay, I'll help you. And then the third thing is with respect to sex, right? That I'm a male, the majority of my participants will be males. But once I'm able to get over this, I'm a student, I'm a Hmong person, I'm a male. Once I'm able to draw onto these kinship ties, these imaginary ties that link Hmong people say for instance, if I were to meet an elderly woman and she happens to have the same clan name that I do, I'll say, yeah, I'm a Yang, and then she'll say, oh, I'm a Yang too, and then I'll say, this is the representative of my community. This is our community elder. And then if she knows that person too, she'll say, call me your aunt then, you know, because we are related somehow. And only when that occurs, that's when I'll be able to conduct interviews with more female participants. And so that's been some of the challenges that I've faced. Another challenge is that speaking Hmong. I grew up here in the States. I grew up going to school with non-Hmong students and speaking English most of my life. I'm more comfortable speaking English than Hmong. So when I do my interviews, undoubtedly, I'll have difficulties, speaking in Hmong, difficulties that come with not knowing where to put the nouns, not knowing where to put the verbs. You know, when I'm saying, say for instance, I'm asking a simple question like, how do you think your experiences in America, or something along those lines. I can't remember off the back of my head, but. And so that was one of the challenges that I faced. And I guess in some ways, that's sort of changed the way I looked at my methodology. To begin with, I was doing a structured interview, but because I couldn't, because I didn't know specifically what to, I knew what I wanted to ask, but because I couldn't ask it in Hmong, I've had to change my method of my interview from structured to semi-structured to letting it be an open-ended interview, where you ask a simple general question and then you have them talk and hope, you cross your fingers, hope to God that, in their talk, they'll have something that I'll address in one of your questions. And so those were the challenges that I experienced. Now, the rewards. Rewards, being able to break through the barriers, being able to connect on not only a scholarly level, but on an individual, intimate level. Because like I said to myself, the lady who I was able to connect with as an aunt, through interviewing her, I certainly learned a lot about, who she is as a person and the sorts of stories that have she more or less changed her life or the sorts of stories that she's remembered. That she continues to tell her children. That's pretty much my presentation. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Pak Hu. I'm a sophomore here. My major is political science, and I just wanted to start out by saying, how grateful I am to get to be a part of this project, for us to get the funding to be able to be researchers and research about things that, we are interested in. I think something that's very important about doing this research project is if you don't have a direction to go in, it's hard to interview the people that you want to interview for your topic, but I just want to say that I'm grateful to have a professor like Dr. Chia to help guide us. My project that I wanted to do, that is something that I was interested in, I titled it The Multicultural, Multifaceted Hmong American Beauty Pageant. And my interest in American beauty pageants is not only to find out how people think about beauty pageants in general, but specifically how beauty pageants reflect people's cultural and their culture and their history. So I want to begin by saying that, growing up in America, you never, and being an and having refugee parents, you never really are able to put yourself in the societal context and understand where you're from. Even in school, learning from the curriculum, it's hard to understand who you are when there's nothing in the history books about your people or about your history. So I think it's important to learn about the immigrant experience and comparing not only our experience to, in America, but comparing our immigrant experience to other immigrant groups too. And I wanted to do research about Hmong American beauty pageants and focus on Hmong specifically because that's something that I know. That's something that that's who I am, so I understand that. And the whole purpose of my project is to figure out how different societal influences have affected how different generations define what is beautiful in their culture. And it's important to understand that Hmong American beauty pageants, like many other American beauty pageants, are strongly influenced by Western culture. But the difference about specific ethnic pageants, you know, when they have it annually, like for example in America, there are various annual beauty pageants that are hosted in California and Minnesota and in Wisconsin and also on the East Coast. But you know, it's something that's very popular in our community, but it's something that I'm sure that maybe the American community doesn't know about. But it's very prevalent in our community, and it's important to figure out, it's important to learn, you know, the importance of these pageants and to learn how they are affected by how we perceive ourselves in the society. Some of the questions that I wanted to address were, what are some of the cultural and social influences that have magnetized the conflicting viewpoints cross-generationally? I know that with the elder generation, they have a different perspective of beauty, and because of their life experiences in Southeast Asia and migrating from China to Southeast Asia, the elder generation that came here as refugees, they have different perspectives of how beauty, of what they define as beautiful. And then for our generation, the younger generation that was born in America, we have a more Western-influenced perception of beauty. And when we host these beauty pageants, it's hard to understand all the criticisms that are coming from everyone because people don't really understand how their life experiences reflect how they view these beauty pageants. And I just want to figure out how the structure affects how people view themselves. Something that motivated me to conduct this oral history research project is because it's important to talk directly to the key participants in a beauty pageant. You know, people think that it's only the coordinators, the judges, and the participants in the beauty pageant, but that's not, those aren't the only participants. Everyone is a participant in community events, especially something that's so public like a beauty pageant event. And it's important to understand how people's thoughts and ideas and perceptions about who they are and what is traditional and what is Hmong is different. And I would have to say that for the elder generation, you know, they're very influenced by Thai and Laotian cultures for the Hmong refugee parents that came here and for the elder generation. But for the younger generation, it's harder for them to see that as being Hmong because they grew up here in American society. So conduct this research, use this oral history research method because it's more personal when you're able to talk to people about their perspectives on beauty pageants, and it's easier to form, you know, it's easier to gather what people's ideal of beauty is when you can talk to them personally and they share their own experiences with how they view other people as beautiful. I mean, there's no like definitive answer that you can use to define somebody as beautiful, but everybody has their own perspectives, and it's influenced by history and by culture. Another question that I also wanted to address in my research was, if culture cannot be contained and it's a progression, then you know, why do some people hold on to such strong beliefs that they claim has always been a way of life? You know, something that's reflected in beauty pageants is that, and especially Hmong American beauty pageants, is that, you know, the elder generation says that the Hmong have always been, you know, more Southeast Asian, more Thai, more Laotian. But, you know, I just wonder, you know, why not more Vietnamese? And I think this poses the question of, you know, what is it about these two other cultures from Southeast Asia that, you know, influences more than, you know, Vietnamese culture? And I think it's because of the Vietnam War and our ties with other cultures too, and how we interact with each other. And that's how it influences our history and our culture and how we view ourselves. And I'm focusing specifically on these beauty pageants because they're such a public event, but they're influenced by such private thoughts, you know, of how people view each other. And I think that's important to tie these experiences and these perspectives to other ethnic immigrant groups too, and their experiences coming to America.
To judge a beauty pageant once, and how can you judge someone doing a traditional dance as their talent to somebody playing Mozart, right? It's fascinating.